You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it's Friday, but Bernie's not with us today. He is in transit, and so he's not available to be on the program today. My apologies and his apologies. But it is also Friday, and it's Anything Goes Friday, so if there's anything that you want to get into, feel free to give us a shout. Just as a heads up, in the next hour, the second hour, Kai Newkirk is going to be with us, who disrupted the Supreme Court during the McCutcheon hearings and to protest Citizens United. And Elliot Richardson with the Small Business Advisory or Advocacy Council in Chicago is going to be with us. They've done this amazing thing with regard to Obamacare that I just, you know, I want to tell you about. And in our third hour, Lamar Waldron is going to be with us. And we're going to be talking about Anthony Bolden, who was I believe he was the first black Secret Service officer, or very early, you know, one of the very, very, very first. And he ended up getting badly burned by the Secret Service for his characterization of what happened the day that Jack Kennedy got shot. And so we will talk about that and Lamar's efforts, our efforts, his and my efforts to get Mr. Bolden a rehearing, as it were. There's a lot of things that we could talk about. A lot of things we've covered throughout the week. Marijuana, by the way, is now officially going to be on the ballot in Alaska. This is going to be really interesting. Can young folks turn out enough of a vote, or is it going to be young folks? I'm noticing demographically a very interesting phenomena that the politics of the left is increasingly being driven. Well, let me start with the right, actually. The politics of the right are increasingly being driven by, and you can see this, by the way, and if you look at the metrics for who watches Fox News, who listens to right-wing talk radio, who watches MSNBC, who listens to left-wing talk radio, the politics of the and also you look at the demographics on the internet. You know, who's reading the right-wing blog sites, who's reading the left-wing blog sites. The right-wing activism in the United States is being driven by and large by people over 65, in fact, in large cases, over 70, the generation that came of age in the 1950s or earlier, the tail end of what was called the greatest generation, and by people, largely white people, in the age group of roughly 30 to 50, that kind of middle age group. Those are your conservative activists and your Tea Partiers. Progressive activism is being driven by and large by the boomers, which are people 55 to 65, more or less, or 50 to 65 right now, and increasingly by people who are under 30. And I just, it's almost like every other generation, you know, it's like it skips a generation. I find it fascinating. So this marijuana, you know, pot legalization being on the Alaska ballot is, my guess is that it's not only going to bring out the boomers who are more left and in favor of pot legalization and the young people who are more left and in favor of pot legalization, but it may bring out a lot of that middle group, the 30 to 50s, who are more, quote, independent or conservative, more likely to listen to Rush Limbaugh, for example, than me. And in some cases, I mean, we're talking, you know, 47 to 53%. These are not huge swings, but they're measurable swings. That group tends to identify itself as libertarian rather than as Republican. That's the group that Rand Paul is speaking to. That's the group that Ron Paul was speaking to. Those kind of middle-aged working folks, by and large white. And the libertarian faction is in favor of decriminalizing pot, too. So that leaves everybody under 70, basically, or at least a majority of everybody under 70, saying, yeah. And these coalitions that are forming even though they may not be overt coalitions, like they show up at the same place in the same room in the same meeting, but they vote the same way, I think are increasingly going to constitute a really significant force in the American political discourse. And I think that you're finding that these three groups, the under 30s, more progressive, the 30s to 50s, more conservative, the 50 to 65, more progressive, that you're going to find these three groups collaborating on things like gay rights, on things like, and again, leaving behind the folks who are the greatest generation, the 70-plus folks who came of age in the 1950s when gay people, you know, I mean, there was an ongoing debate about whether Liberace was gay, right, for years and years and years, or at least there seemed to be a debate in the mainstream media, or just no discussion about it at all, just as a kind of for example. That over 70 generation, there's a lot of good Democrats in there. But there's also, you know, that old-fashioned kind of Barry Goldwater Republican group. My dad would have been in that group. And so they're going to vote against marijuana legalization. They're going to vote against marriage equality. But then you get some interesting issues like, you know, do you want a fracking well in your backyard? Or have you noticed that the weather has just gone flat out bat guano crazy? Might that have something to do with our having put 350 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere since the Civil War? And it's picking up speed, the rate at which we're throwing carbon into the atmosphere. So there's that. I toss that out. And the other is Adolph Reed Jr. has an interesting piece in Harper's right now. It's called The Long, Slow Surrender of American Liberals. And he points out, he suggests that basically the high point of the liberal movement in the United States, in the memory of anybody who's still alive. I mean, we can point to high points of progressive movements back around the turn of the 1900s, at the turn of that century, the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century, and progressive movements, at least with regard to ending slavery in the 1840s, 1850s, arguably the 1830s. You could characterize the American Revolution as a progressive movement. Certainly George Washington did. But anyhow, he says that the high point, you know, in modern history came in 1944 when Franklin Roosevelt, actually a president of the United States, actually came out and said, we should write into the Constitution, or at least into law, that every person who is a citizen of this country has the right to a job. And if capitalism fails to provide that, the government will provide that. The right to medical care. And if capitalism fails to provide that, the government will provide that. And the right to not be afraid economically of old age, sickness, accident, or unemployment. It's virtually word for word from the president of the United States. Now, I can't imagine a president of the United States today, even a Democrat, going out, you know, coming out and saying, we need a new Bill of Rights that says you have a right to health care, you have a right to housing, you have a right to a job, you have a right to security in old age, not to fall into poverty. And he points out that the right has this kind of clear-eyed utopian vision of the world, and the left has gotten kind of muddy. I'm going to come back and talk about that a little bit more in 4 minutes. Then we'll pick up your calls.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So anything goes Friday, 866-97-THOM. I see a whole bunch of folks are on the line right now. We will get to your calls as we continue through the program. And welcome back. Randy, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network in Montevallo, Alabama. Am I saying that right, Randy?
That's right.
Hey,
that's
what's up?
That's right, Tom. Thank you for everything you do.
Well, back at you, Randy. What you wanted to talk about the Fed?
Yeah, well, Tom, the old axiom, the gig is up, is where I want to talk. And that is to ask you, I believe if for example, the gig would be up if we audited the Fed. What are some of your thoughts about other things that could be done to kind of say, hey, the gig is up?
Yeah. Well, we audited, Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul, that coalition that I'm talking about, right? You know, the progressive and the libertarian Republican, actually got passed into law as part of the bailout bill, the Obama bailout bill, or the Obama stimulus, I guess it was, the economic stimulus, that the Fed would be audited for 1 year, for the year of, I think it was 2008, the year of the Great Crash. And what they discovered in that audit was that the Fed passed out over $30 trillion, as I recall, much of it to wealthy individuals, to foreign banks, to foreign corporations, to American corporations. I mean, the Fed wasn't just bailing out banks. They were bailing out pretty much anybody who was really, really rich and in trouble. And that's one of the most underreported stories, I think, of the last decade, and needs to be more exposed. Another one is that there was an attempt to audit the Pentagon. And this was back during the Clinton administration, as I recall. I'd have to do a search on it to find exactly when it was. But sometime in my lifetime and in my recent lifetime, there was an attempt to audit the Pentagon. And the initial audit discovered that there was $1 trillion missing. And my understanding is, I've read this in several places, although I haven't seen an authoritative source for it, but everybody seems to be pointing to one, that now the best guess of the amount of money that is missing from the Pentagon is around $2 trillion. We know that billions of dollars, an amount of money, physical money, actual physical $100 bills on pallets, was shipped over to Iraq. Billions and billions of dollars were shipped to Iraq, large enough to be seen from outer space. I mean, there's apparently Google Earth pictures that show these giant pallets of money coming off these trucks, and that has vanished. And so, those would be two. I mean, the Fed and the Pentagon would be two gigs are up. I would love to see, an exposure of what the big banks are up to, too.
Well, I'd like to know more about the Bilderbergs.
Well, the Bilderbergs, that's an annual meeting, and it's become basically a social club. There's no business structure around that. The same thing with the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations. It's basically become I'm a high status person because I'm a member of this kind of thing. There is a group of hedge fund guys who get together either once a week or once a month. The New Yorker, I think, did an expose on this about a half a year ago. We reported it on this in this program, where they get together in somebody's living room and basically, plot strategy. That's all about, guys who are making over $1 billion a year on Wall Street every year, getting together and figuring out how they can increase that. But this whole, worldwide banking conspiracy thing, it's not limited to banks. It's the TPP. This is what this is all about. It's ultimately the goal is to have a worldwide oligarchy, basically. Of these giant corporations. Randy, thanks for the call. Okay, so the final thing I wanted to say is, and what I took home from Adolf Reed's piece in Harper's, The Long Slow Surrender of American Liberals, to boil it down to a couple of sentences, and it's not all that inconsistent with stuff that I've been saying for years, but he says it really well, and I'm not although this is my take of his take, it's not necessarily his take. He would probably disagree were he on this program right now, and try to put a lot more nuance in it. But anyhow, my take of it is that on the right, there is this clear-eyed utopian vision, and it runs something like this. If only government got so small that the marketplace could genuinely operate and make its trillions of decisions every second as individual buyers and sellers get together and make decisions. If only the government completely got out of the marketplace, got out of the way, then this perfect marketplace would create a perfect utopia. And getting government out of the way is going to mean the government's not going to cost as much, and so it's going to reduce taxes, which are also a drag on that perfect marketplace. And so we need to reduce taxes dramatically and we need to reduce regulation dramatically, and we need to just get government out of the way. And if we do that, the world will be wonderful. Now, that's the sales pitch on the right. And there's a lot of people who believe that. The libertarians, I mean, this is the core kernel of this utopian view of libertarians. It's the core kernel of the utopian view that's pitched in Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, where the rich people all went on strike because they got sick and tired of the government telling them what to do and of the labor unions hassling them. And when the rich people went on strike, society turned into chaos and the country fell apart. And the rich people, led by John Galt, started this, you know, their own little libertarian experiment in this other place. Now, the fact of the matter is that this has never been successfully tried anywhere in the world, and every time it has been tried, what you've ended up with is monopoly and rule by the super rich and basically despotism. It's basically you end up with revisiting feudalism, kingdoms. But still, there is a clear-eyed utopian vision on the right that they can sell to people. And that, and you know, folks like the Koch brothers and other billionaires who fund this vision love it, because the more government gets out of the way, the more they can dominate marketplaces. So what's the clear-eyed utopian vision on the left? During the time of FDR, it was government can be a force for good. We together as society are government. Government should balance the excesses and the thefts that come along with capitalism. And it should do so by some fundamental and simple principles. You have the right to free speech. You have the right to a government that's not corrupt. You have the right to a job. You have the right to an education, including a college education. The way the post-FDR folks did this was with the GI Bill, which doubled the number of college graduates in the United States. So basically, you have these fundamental rights. Hey, Alan, you have these fundamental rights, and along with these rights will come a utopian world, right? This was a utopian vision, too. Everything will work out just fine. If we can, you know, it might not work out as well for the billionaires, but they'll be fine. They might just be worth hundreds of millions. But hey, you know, you can get by on $100 million or $500 million or $900 million. And yeah, you know, Roosevelt said they hate me and I welcome their hatred, but you know, it was all about saying, you know, we're going to create this base. And he set about doing that in 1933, creating the WPA and the CCC and all these other agencies where he was basically, these agencies were, you know, now modern libertarian conservatives would say, oh my God, that was big government run amok. FDR would say, this is we the people collectively saying we all have a right to a job. And when General Motors isn't providing the job, when ExxonMobil isn't providing the job, when Walmart's not providing the job, government will. And there's no shortage of things that we all agree need to be done that are not being done by capitalism. Capitalism wasn't building an interstate highway system. Capitalism wasn't building railroads. Those were paid, you know, the railroad lines, the original beds. Abe Lincoln gave away what in today's dollars would be tens of billions, maybe even hundreds of billions of dollars to the big railroads in terms of land, outright grants. Same thing with the internet. Shane was remarking to me this morning that, you know, this guy from Verizon, he just said, you know, the CEO of Verizon, and this has gone viral today, people who use the internet more should pay more. Well, it kind of sounds kind of logical, right? Except that we built the internet. Those backbone structures, those big national backbone structures, those were public-private partnerships. The government paid a good chunk of that, and large parts of it that weren't paid for by the government were paid for by private industry were paid for using property, you know, rights of way taken by use of the Fifth Amendment of eminent domain, taken from people, and now Verizon owns it. or Cogent or Comcast, and they're saying, we own this, but you didn't build it. You know, this privatization of the internet is not that different than, you know, the interstate highway system. The difference is we can see it with the interstate highway system. If somebody were to say, okay, you know, from Ohio to Colorado, that being the backbone, we're going to just hand this off to Acme Company, you know, which is going to put all kinds of tolls along the way. We've done this, by the way, with our railroads. One of the big problems Amtrak has on the East Coast is that the rails are in bad shape because they're owned by private corporations that won't upgrade.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the question is, how do we recapture that cogent, clear-eyed, utopian left vision? Okay, once again, let me say, I'm not saying that everybody of any particular age is any particular politics. I'm saying that there have been these slight shifts that have been moving American politics. And they seem to show up. Every other generation seems to just slightly move one way or the other based on what I'm seeing. Now, it could be that one of the reasons for, well, I don't know. I don't want to speculate too much about this. I don't, because this is the, you know, who is liberal and who is conservative and who is in favor of or not in favor of growing pot is not the point that I wanted to make. The point that I wanted to make is that there used to be this clear-eyed vision that the left all agreed on, and the left used to control the Democratic Party. There is a clear-eyed vision that the right agrees on, which is basically business does things always better than government, and so whenever possible, get rid of government and give it to business. And that controls the Republican Party. But the Democratic Party has been fractured in a whole bunch of different ways by the folks who think that, the folks who are backed with FDR, which I would say is like kind of the Bernie Sanders crowd and the Progressive Caucus. And I'm just, you know, how do we get back to a clear progressive vision of government that works, of a country that works? I think, you know, Reagan's presidency so damaged that idea. And that damage has been so severe and so long lasting that the Democratic Party and the left itself, frankly, has moved to the right. So I guess I'm identifying myself as an old left lefty. But anyow, I just wanted to toss out some food for thought. Let's pick up some phone calls and talk about this stuff. Gordon in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Gordon, what's up?
Yes, hang on just a second, Bob.
Sure. It says here you wanted to talk about LBJ and Medicare and all that kind of stuff. I'm assuming you're pulling off to the side of the road.
No, I'm actually in a room where you can actually hear me. I'm at work.
Okay.
So.
Oh, okay.
So I just wanted to know, when LBJ passed Medicare into law, why didn't he make it Medicare for all? And not only that, why is dental not covered under Medicare? Or under private insurance, for that matter.
Right.
Why is it separate?
Okay, these are two very separate issues. Let me deal with dental first. Dental is not covered because dentists have tended to be a cash business rather than an insurance-driven business. Their business model is very different than the rest of medicine, and they like it that way. You know, you can make a lot of money as a dentist, and so. Dentists have never played well with others, I guess, it's very hard to get actual dental insurance. What you can buy are what are called dental insurance plans that are actually basically co-marketing agreements where a bunch of dental groups get together and say, you know, we'll give a discount to people if they only patronize us, that kind of thing. So that's the dental thing. With regard to Medicare for All, the sales pitch that LBJ used to get the insurance companies to agree with him to go along with Medicare. And this was squeaker, squeaker tight, and he almost lost it at the last minute. And the big fear that caused him to almost lose it at the last minute was that it was leaked to the press that either Johnson or Humphrey, one of them, had said eventually we're going to make Medicare available to everybody. And Congress went crazy. I mean, if that leak had happened on the eve of the vote today, with the internet and Drudge Report and right-wing talk radio across America, Medicare never would have passed. But in any case, Medicare was really close, and the sales pitch that LBJ used to get the insurance companies to go along with it was, I will take your most expensive and sickest patients off your hands and thus increase your profits. You make profit off people until they're 65, and when they get to be 65, they start getting expensive for you. You're stuck with them because they've been buying insurance from you all these years, and you don't want to be stuck with them. I'll take them off your hands. And the insurance company said, that's great. It's going to make us more money. And in fact, it did. It made the insurance industry get larger and more profitable as a consequence of Medicare passing. So there's the story for you. And I see that Bob has dropped off the call. So Ash is in Chicago. Hey, Ash, what's up?
All right, Tom. I was on the internet yesterday and going over like foreign exchange rates between countries, and I was going over the foreign exchange rate between Vietnam and America. Now it appears that $1 of our one American dollar is equivalent to like 20,000 Vietnamese dongs, and I'm wondering, is that a major factor in between these trade deals? Because 20,000 dongs goes a long way for the Vietnamese people.
Right. What's a major factor for the trade? You're right. 20,000 dongs does go a long way. That's why the minimum wage in Vietnam is 26 cents a day. At least according to, I had James Hoffa on the TV show last night, and that's what he said, you know, so that's my source for that. But I think that he's probably right. And let's keep in mind, Vietnam is not a democracy. You know, it's the Communist Republic of Vietnam, and it's more of an autocratic government. And increasingly, it's becoming an oligarchic government now that, you know, they're being exploited by big business and transnational corporations, and they're being used. The same thing is happening in China. The richest folks in China, compared to the average Chinese, are vastly richer now, 7 to 8 times. I was reading this morning in the Financial Times, actually. They're 7 to 8 times richer than the richest Americans compared to the average American. So, you know, China is rapidly becoming created an oligonomy and becoming an oligarchy. And so what we're seeing is this challenge to democracy all over the world. Actually, it was The Economist. I was reading that. The Economist has this now weekly special report. And their special report today, I read it. I didn't really like it all that much. It was very neoliberal in its perspective. It was basically saying we need to shrink governments and everybody has to have a balanced budget. But they made that point, in any case, what's going on with China. The fact that it takes 20,000 dongs to buy a dollar is in and of itself meaningless. Vietnam could revalue its currency. In fact, I remember I was in Israel just by coincidence back in the late 70s or early 80s when they revalued the shekel. And they literally said, okay, 100 shekels is now 10 shekels. And they issued new currency and new bills. And so if you had 100 shekels, you now had 10. And it just, you know, changed it. I used to have, in fact, I still have in one of my wallets someplace, either 100 or 1,000 ruble note, the Russian ruble, and they revalued the ruble. So a country can change their currency, they can revalue their currency, and it's done all the time. I don't know if the dong is a floating currency or not. The other thing that I know about Forex, about the Forex exchanges, the foreign exchange exchanges, is that these are places where the big boys play. These are the places where the George Soroses of the world play. And people who think that they're going to get into foreign exchange trading, foreign currency trading, as a way to make money are you know, it's like playing in traffic. It's like little kids playing in traffic. It's a very, very dangerous thing to do. So, Ashes, I hope that answers your question. Robert in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, Robert, you wanted to talk about Move to Amend?
Yeah, sort of. I'm an old lefty like you. We're the same age, Tom.
Uh-huh.
I remember getting the vote in 72. I guess we both got the vote from McGovern. He won one state.
Yep.
Not even his own. And that was when young people were active because there was still a draft and a raging war going on in Vietnam. You were just talking about.
Yes.
But I wanted to argue the point. You talk about Move to Amend and you compare it with giving the 18-year-olds the right to vote, or possibly with the repeal of Prohibition, which were slam dunks. The political pros knew that young people don't vote in numbers, so throwing a bone to 18-year-olds really didn't cost any skin off anybody's rear end.
Well, yes and no. If you're old enough to remember voting, Robert, you're old enough to remember what Nixon ran on in 72. And what he ran on in 72 was that he had a plan to end the Vietnam War within the next 12 months. It was a secret what the details.
He ran on that in 68.
I know that. I know. And he ran on that in 72 as well. And it was, you know, people bought it. I mean, it's I'm not a good person to dissect the election of 72, but my point is that
we can't undo history, but I think that it's kind of a little bit simplistic and naive. I know you're cheerleading the cause, and Move to Amend is a good idea to roll back Citizens United and so forth, but to get people thinking that it's a matter of a few months that they can undo this when you're taking on the powers that be and they're going to aim all their guns at you.
I agree, Robert. I agree. I think David Cobb is right. He thinks it's going to be at least 5 to 10 years before we can get a constitutional amendment like this passed. I sadly, agree, because we have to organize. We have to wake up enough people that there's, a solid 20, 25, 30% of the American people who feel passionate about it. Right now, it's probably 3 or 4%. Robert, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That said, if 3 or 4%... If those people, if all of us were to just tell three other people, we've now become 12%. And then they tell two people, you become 20%. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Tony, watching Free Speech TV in Searsmont, Maine. You wanted to talk about diabetes?
Tom. Yes. I just want to thank you for helping to elevate the psyche of America, including myself. You do such a wonderful job. I really appreciate what you have to offer.
Thank you.
I also want to tell you about this book that came out about a year ago. It's called There is a Cure for Diabetes. And it's written by a man named Gabriel Cousins, C-O-U-S-E-N-S.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an MD, a psychiatrist, a doctor of natural medicine, a master of Ayurvedics.
What's his cure?
Well, it's not simple. You should get the book and read it. He has the most deepest, most profound understanding of the syndrome, diabetic syndrome, of anyone I've ever came across.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, he puts people on a raw vegan diet, and not just any raw vegan diet, a very special one. And he has actually cured type 1 diabetes in some of his people, and that's never been done before. I think he's one of the, well, he's considered to be one of the world's experts on human nutrition today.
Right.
And he has a place in Patagonia, Arizona, called the Tree of Life Rejuvenation Center.
Mm-hmm.
And he's helped like tens of thousands of people heal from all kinds of catastrophic diseases. And the basis of his teachings are being on a raw vegan diet.
Yeah. My old friend Don Hoy used to run a center in Michigan called the Creative Health Institute. And
uh-huh.
he was doing the Ann Wigmore diet. And in fact, he started as a student of Ann's, and then Ann died and her organization moved in a somewhat different direction than he thought she would like to see it go. So he went off and started his own thing. Don just died a year or two ago. In fact, he's the guy who used to always say, "I'm great, but I'll get better." I stole that phrase from him. And Don was just a dear friend. He and I were both ordained in the Coptic Church at the same time, way back in the day, back in the late 60s, early 70s. And he was getting amazing results using a raw vegan, 100% raw vegan diet, and a lot of wheatgrass juice. But type 1 diabetes, I mean, with type 1 diabetes, you've got somebody who during their childhood, their pancreas had an infection and it killed off large chunks of the Isle of Langerhans, the part of the pancreas that produces insulin. And I can see where a diet that doesn't evoke any insulin response, you know, maybe you could get by if you had partial damage. But if somebody really, truly had wiped out the entire Isle of Langerhans by, you know, the best guess is it's a viral infection in childhood.
Well, that's true, and he acknowledges that. He said he was even shocked to find that 21% of his study group in type 1 diabetics, he considers them cured, and he uses a lot of criteria for that, which are much more rigid than the American Medical Association. And one of the criteria is they're off all medication.
Right.
And the other criteria is they have a consistently have a fasting blood sugar of 100 or less.
Right. But see, that's only 20%, which means that the 80% had the whole, you know, that whole piece of the pancreas was entirely wiped out rather than partially wiped out. But, you know, yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said for these raw food vegan diets, both as healing diets and as maintenance diets. Don ate that diet until the day he died. He died in his 80s in a house fire. So he was a brilliant guy. Tony, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. James in Waterbury, Connecticut. You wanted to speak to the issue of progressives and movements and politics?
That's correct, Tom. Thanks for having me on your show, and thanks for all that you do for the progressive movement, Tom.
Thank you.
I was reading an article in the Huffington Post, actually, earlier this week, and it says millennials and progressives agree on a lot of stuff when it comes to ending the war and same-sex marriage. And I just became a progressive the other day, actually, because I was frustrated with my political party as it is, and I'm being personally attacked for that. So having said that, what can progressives and Democrats do to win in November?
I think that this gets back to the kind of tail end of my earlier rant, James, is that we need to articulate a clear vision. And in my opinion, that clear vision has been largely lost. Bill Clinton campaigned in 1992 on what he called his the New Covenant speech. And it was basically a New Deal kind of thing. If you read his New Covenant speech, his stump speech, it was very progressive. It was basically, you know, the government will step in and catch you when you fall and provide some baseline for people. That it is, you know, if capitalism can't provide you with a job, government would, that healthcare should be a right, not a privilege. I mean, there's a number of things. And in fact, I wrote a whole chapter critiquing that speech in my book Threshold, and which I should put online. I should see if I can get permission to put that chapter online, because I think it's a pretty good analysis. The problem is he didn't govern that way. You know, once he was elected on that. So it's like, nowadays, politicians talk a good line, and on the right, the same complaint happens. You know, on the right, people say, "Oh, you know, George Bush said, you know, when he was running for re-election in 2004, that he was going to, amend the Constitution, or he was, you know, to ban gay marriage. That was his big thing, and he was going to end abortion in America, and he didn't do either one." And so it's like at a certain level, the base gets played as suckers by politicians. On the other hand, maybe it's just an issue of real politic. I mean, you know, you keep appealing to those ideals, and then, you know, you get into power and you do everything you can to move in that direction, but you can't really move the whole way unless it's in one of those 80-year cycles that I talk about in Crash of 2016. So
one other quick question.
Yeah, go for it.
Should I stick with people who believe the same progressives I do, like my friend Ebony K. Williams on the internet? Because I feel like she and others like yourself, I feel like you guys are the only idea people who get me, because I'm being attacked left and right for supporting President Obama and supporting progressive ideas. I mean, what do you think? I'm a young guy. I'm 24. I'm African-American. I have autism.
I think that it's useful to, James, for us to all learn to think for ourselves. And President Obama has campaigned on many progressive positions, but I would not characterize him as a progressive. I'd characterize him as a Democrat, you know, as a more kind of a mainstream Democrat who has promoted some progressive positions, but he's also promoted some positions that are very much not progressive. And so, you know, this gets us into that kind of the religion thing. You know, there are some folks who are like religious deli eaters, you know, that, well, I'll have a little bit of reincarnation from here, and I'll have a little bit of prayer from here, and I'll have a little bit of singing from here, and I'll have, you know, whatever it may be. And they kind of create their own religion. I think that that's a natural human tendency and inclination, as opposed to just saying, this is who I am, this is what I am, here's this little slot that I fit into. I would counsel you, James, to beware of little slots, of narrow slots, and try to educate yourself as much as you can. Thank you for the call. It's good to hear from you. Ali in Minneapolis, listening on KTNF. Hey, Ali.
That's okay, just like Ali Cat.
Ali, okay.
Ali, yeah. Tom, I want to have a clarification, if I could, please. I was bringing clothes from the laundry upstairs, and I heard you saying something about people over 70 being unlikely to vote for legalization of marijuana and not supporting marriage equality.
Not people over 70, just the majority of people over 70. It could be a 51%, but by and large, that's how the polling works.
This old hippie would like to remind you that the people over 70 now are the ones who demonstrated for civil rights, demonstrated
yes.
against the war, brought you the right to the 18-year-olds the right to vote, and tried to strike down the draft, and we smoked it, and we loved people, and baby, that's it.
Okay, excellent point. Maybe I should say over 75. I mean, I'm basically looking at Bill O'Reilly's demographics. You know who his viewers are, and you see these, you know, the ads on these Fox shows for Geritol, basically. I mean, Geritol isn't advertising anymore, but you know what I'm talking about, for things that very elderly people use, for catheters. And it's a clue to who the audience is. But yeah, your point is well taken, Ali. I'm understating the age of the boomer generation.
Well, yes, our generation was the post-war generation. And I do believe with my heart of hearts that we were the ones that should have carried forward the liberal and the progressive agenda that FDR defined, and somehow we dropped the ball right with George McGovern.
Well, there was actually this huge backlash in 52. I mean, you know, that's probably before your time, before you were.
No, it's not, because I was a political animal since the day my grandfather made me listen to Harold Stassen as a Republican candidate for president.
Oh my. Okay. So, yeah. So you know the whole story. And there was that Republican hiccup, you know, in 46, where mm-hmm. Harry Truman ended up in 47 with the election of 46 and 47, you know, Taft-Hartley got passed, and Harry Truman proposed a national health care system, Medicare for all, and he couldn't get it even out of, you know, couldn't even get a floor vote on it. Go ahead.
That there's some sad things that happen when people think of politics or think of their own political party as the politic of the day, rather than saying politics is a part of what makes the democracy run, and I will be a bipartisan or a compromiser if it requires to get something good accomplished.
Yeah, well said. Ali, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to KTNF. We'll be back in just a moment with Kai Newkirk, an organizer with Activist 99 Rise.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. and EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Kai Newkirk is on the line with us. He's an organizer and activist with 99RISE. 99RISE.org is the website. Kai, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, what's 99RISE?
We're a grassroots organization that is fighting for progressive change, and we're focused on ending corruption, winning real democracy. And we're doing that through nonviolent civil resistance.
And 99, I'm assuming, is referring to the 99% of us?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, a lot of us were inspired by Occupy Wall Street and wanted to carry that fight forward with a focus on ending corruption and getting money out of politics as the first step to a lot of the change that we need to see.
That's great. And it seems that from where I'm sitting, that it looks like the number one thing that has been corrupting politics is money, and the reason why money has been corrupting politics is because the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, arguably going back to the early 19th century, but really getting aggressive about it once Lewis Powell was put on the court in the 70s, particularly with the Buckley case, where they found that money was protected by the First Amendment, and in the First National Bank case, where they found that corporations were protected by the 14th Amendment, and then in Citizens United, where they brought these two together and amplified both of them and said, yes, definitely money is protected by the First Amendment, and although the founders didn't see fit to write the word money into that, and definitely corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment, although the people who fought the Civil War to free the slaves didn't see fit to write that into the 14th Amendment. So you had something to say about this the other day.
Yes, we did. You're right. It's a long history that's led to the current, profound state of corruption that has basically amounted to us having not so much a democracy, but a government out vying for the worst of the 1%. And, we wanted to shine a light on that and dramatize this issue as the moral crisis it is. And with the pending decision on the McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission case that a lot of eyes have been on, we saw this as an opportunity to do that. So, we went in to the Supreme Court on Wednesday, like anybody else would in the public. And when we were in there and they were arguing another case, I stood up and said that I'm rising on behalf of the vast majority of Americans who believe that money is not speech, that corporations are not people, and that our democracy should not be for sale to the highest bidder. I got a few more words in, and then I was tackled, pulled out, and...
Yeah, I saw. I watched the YouTube. I watched the video of it. It's pretty cool. Although I can't, of course, on the air advocate breaking the law, which is what I think you did, or at least broke decorum. Were you charged with anything?
Yes, I was. I was. I was held overnight. I was charged with basically making a speech in the Supreme Court. Pleaded not guilty. I have a trial coming up, but. For us, at 99RISE.org, we see ourselves as following humbly in a long American tradition of folks that have used nonviolent civil disobedience to fight to extend and defend democracy from the abolitionists to the suffragists, the civil rights movement, to the dreamers of today.
Right.
Folks who understood that sometimes you have to put your body on the line and be willing to disrupt business as usual in order to make change. And so we're taking that tradition forward to separate wealth and state and establish political equality, real democracy in our country. And if that means that I and some others have to, go to jail, it's a small price to pay to really defend our freedom.
We're talking with Kai Newkirk. He's an activist and organizer with 99RISE.org. 99RISE.org is the website. And Kai, are you familiar with the work that Move to Amend is doing? David Cobb and Caitlin and all that whole bunch that
yeah.
are. What are your thoughts on
great.
That?
I think it's great. There's a lot of great folks and organizations that are doing stuff. I think it's one of the things that gives me hope is that there's more of a sense of movement with a lot of different things in play right now. And we're trying to come in, and play the role of using nonviolent direct action and making bold, taking bold action and making deeper sacrifices to really dramatize this issue and create a sense of moral urgency around it that can move some of the millions of Americans who agree with us but are right now being passive, to move them into active, to taking action. We feel like that's the essential task to winning right now. So,
yeah. It seems like it's almost like, you know, different roles within a movement. If you look at the abolition movement, if you look at the suffrage movement, if you look at the civil rights movement, what you find is that there were groups of people who were just very clearly the educators, and the kind of I don't want to call it establishment movement building, but you know, just the careful, quiet movement builders. And then there were the troublemakers. There were the people who got out in the streets, you know, and who put their bodies in front of the tanks, metaphorically. In Tiananmen Square, it was literal. And Move to Amend folks are the educators. And, I mean, obviously you're doing a fair amount of education, but you're putting standing up in the Supreme Court, you're putting your body on the line. You're putting your safety, your freedom on the line. What provoked you to do that? What brought you into 99 Rise?
Well, you know, I'm just another American who really loves my country. I've been a community organizer, working to be of service and to make our country work for everybody for years, over a decade or so. And I've come to see that, in my view and many others and folks in 99 Rise, that if we don't win on this issue, if we don't address the question of democracy and the crisis of corruption, and really put the power of governing back in the hands of people and out of the hands of, just those with great wealth, that we're not going to be able to move forward and address the urgent problems that we have in the country and make progress. Yeah. I've devoted myself to this fight along with others. And, we're really excited and inspired to see the way that people have responded to this action and have been sharing it and promoting it on social media, going to the website, saying they want to sign up, they want to get involved. Because this is, like I said, 96% of people in a recent poll basically are on our side, that they see reducing the corruption of money in politics as a real priority.
Mm-hmm.
But so few of those folks are really taking action.
What do you see as the best way to end the influence of money as a corrupting influence on politics? What, if you could just get everybody to say, yes, I will do that, I'll support that, or wave a magic wand or whatever, what would it take in your mind?
Well, we think that we need a constitutional amendment and federal legislation. There's been over a dozen different amendments proposed and a lot of great proposals in terms of legislation. We support all that. And think that we just need to make sure that the reform meets the test of establishing political equality and making sure that private wealth is not the determinant of political power anymore.
Yeah.
I think most folks would say who are involved in 99 Rise that means getting private money out of public elections, period. But we see our role as not so much the legislative experts, but as folks who are really going to help to drive the change by taking action, doing campaigns that dramatize this issue, that create a sense of moral urgency, and move people to be willing to make the kind of sacrifices and take action that are going to make any change possible, especially the fundamental reform that we need to settle this question for posterity, for our country.
Totally with you. What has 99 Rise endorsed a particular constitutional amendment to take money out of politics, or are you just generally supportive of that movement, whether it be Ralph Nader's group, Common Cause, Public Citizen, mm-hmm. I believe it is, or Move to Amends, right, or whatever?
We haven't taken a stand really on particular amendments. Like I said, we support the range of proposals that have been made, and we feel like at a later point in the movement, we'll need to bring folks together to really coalesce at the time when we have the power to win that demand.
Somebody called earlier and said, how long is it going to be before we hit that critical mass? David Cobb thinks it's going to be 10 years. What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. That timeline can be dramatically accelerated by powerful campaigns and nonviolent action.
There you go. Yeah, I absolutely agree. Kai Newkirk. Hang on just a second, Kai.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Kai Newkirk, the website is 9999rise.org. Kai, thanks for being with us today.
So great to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Welcome back. Dean in Camino, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Dean, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'd just like to say I totally agree with it, Kai Newkirk. And has anybody ever discussed term limits for the Supreme Court justices? I feel that they've been stacked with conservatives, and they were the ones that passed the law that allowed money to be basically the equivalent of a vote. And,
yeah.
And you know, a long time ago, the Republicans got they didn't think they'd ever get the presidency back. And when Franklin Delano Roosevelt got his fourth term, they changed the Constitution so that term limits could be put on a president. How about term limits on Supreme Court justices?
Well, this is what Franklin Roosevelt proposed in 1937. He suggested that, in effect, all members of the Supreme Court who were 70 years old or older, and at that point in time there were either three or four members of the court who were 70 or older, all of them should get in aggregate one vote, which was the majority will of that of all the people who were over 70. And they would have one vote, and they would be each would be considered a Supreme Court justice emeritus. Right now you've got the Chief Justice and you have associate justices. He was going to create a third category called Justice Emeritus, which would be all the 70-year-olds, right, and older. And collectively they would have one vote, and because that was, let's say that there was four of them at that time, that would mean that that four votes on the court now becomes one vote, so there's three openings on the court, and so he could appoint three new justices, and that would tip the balance of the court. And he was roundly condemned, principally by conservatives, for suggesting this. But it's perfectly legal. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution gives to Congress the power to regulate the Supreme Court. In fact, it says Congress, as the Supreme Court, shall operate under rules established by Congress. And so, or regulations, actually, I think is the word that the Constitution uses. And so FDR was simply saying, let's regulate the Supreme Court. I read a book maybe two or three years ago now. It's been a while since I read it. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the title or the author, but I found it fairly easily by searching for, you know, FDR court packing. And it was the book that's been written on the topic of that year, that era and that year and what FDR did. And I'm going to have to, it's when we moved down to the boat, we packed everything up. So I'm not even sure I still have the book easily available. I think it's in a storage unit. But the author suggested and provided a lot of good historical narrative that agreed with that suggestion that FDR dropped his court packing scheme because the court started voting to agree with him in 37, just spontaneously as a result of this public pressure that came about as a result of FDR doing this. But had he pushed, he probably would have passed. It probably would have passed both the House and the Senate. And he should have pushed, in fact, for that, because to this day it would have had the result of increasing the turnover on the court, which would be a good thing. So I think, you know, it would be great if we had a new FDR and if we had a new suggestion, as FDR had put forward in 1937, that anybody over 70 on the court, all the 70-year-olds, become one vote in aggregate. The effect of that would be that people would only be on the court for 10 or 20 years, typically, rather than 30, 40 years, and, you know, new generations would come in. Dean, thanks a lot for the call. Elliot Richardson is going to be with us next to tell you about some exciting new developments going on in Chicago. Stick around. But you have to find something to do. I mean, Article 3, Section 2 is... Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Shane and I are. Shane says, "Well, you know, if Congress had passed the law saying that, you know, everybody over 70 on the Supreme Court is a justice emeritus, and collectively they get one vote, the Supreme Court would just overturn it. They would declare it unconstitutional." And I said, "No, they wouldn't." And he's like, "Sure, they can do anything they want. Marbury versus Madison." And I'm like, "No, they have to find a fig leaf." And well, I don't know. Shane is still shrugging his shoulders. I guess I am too. Who knows what the Supreme Court would do? What kind of a fig leaf do they have in saying that money is protected by the First Amendment? I mean, it's so the First Amendment does not have the word money in it anywhere. What kind of fig leaf do they have in saying that the 14th Amendment protects corporations? The word corporation isn't there anywhere. And in fact, the history of the 14th Amendment is quite clear to everybody. We fought a civil war to end slavery, and then we passed the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to end slavery, not to free the corporations. But anyhow, speaking of corporations, smaller corporations, friendlier corporations, community-based corporations, Elliot Richardson is the CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. SBACIL.org is their website, and there'll be a link to that over at TomHartmann.com as well today. And Elliot, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Tom, thank you for having me as always. It's great to be on with you.
Thank you for joining us. Let me just recap what we talked about the last time you were on the air, and you can correct me if my memory is wrong, and then I want to find out what's happened since then. My understanding is you're basically sort of a small business alternative to the Chamber of Commerce. I'm not sure if you would describe yourself that way, but I think I can. And for small businesses in the Chicago area, and you were trying to get enough businesses together who would be interested in buying health insurance from a nonprofit rather than from one of these big giant for-profit corporations. From a nonprofit that you could put together basically your own health insurance co-op, and if it hit a certain critical mass, it could be offered through Obamacare to small businesses in the Chicago area. Do I have that right?
You know what? You're pretty close, so let me take you through it.
Okay.
If that's okay. Yeah, you know, about 4 years ago, so the SBAC, we are completely nonpartisan. We're laser-focused on impacting small businesses, and that probably differentiates us from some other business groups. You know, our goal is to bring change and to bring a higher quality of life, frankly, to small business owners and our employees. So about 4 years ago, health insurance, long before President Obama was President Obama, before Obamacare, health insurance rates were killing small businesses. That's all that I can say. It was killing my small business. So we came up with this concept of building a co-op, and we drafted legislation for that, and we were able to get the ability in Illinois to build a health insurance co-op, which is an insurance company, essentially a mutual, owned by the businesses and the entrepreneurs and the employees in the co-op and operated by our advocates. And that was a tough fight, I'll tell you that. I mean, we had to lobby against the insurance companies. You know, the concept of increased competition does not make them extremely excited, especially in Illinois, where Blue Cross and Blue Shield is very strong. But we got that done. And then there was funding through the Affordable Care Act, which allows capital money to actually build these cooperatives. And right now there is a wonderful co-op in Illinois called Land of Lincoln, and the SBAC is very supportive of it. We're trying to get the word out and you know, how this disruptive product could really change the nature of health insurance in the state of Illinois.
That is great. So this predated Obamacare, but Obamacare has helped, or the Affordable Care Act has helped it along. We're talking with Elliot Richardson, the CEO of the Small Business Advocacy Council. That's this SBAC, Illinois. SBACIL.org is the website. And so where are you at now, and when will companies be able to participate, or can they already, or what's going with the Land of Lincoln program?
Yeah, they can already. And yeah, you know, it was great because this did predate Obamacare, and we had strong support from business groups and trade organizations, both, you know, that would traditionally identify themselves on the right, Tom, and also on the left, because, you know, health insurance rates don't discriminate. They go up whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. We've got this thing up and running. Land of Lincoln is up and running. The nice thing about Land of Lincoln is it's in partnership with the Metropolitan Chicago Hospital Group in Illinois. So you've got medical providers and small business owners working together to bring this product to Illinois. And yeah, they're writing insurance policies right now. The SBAC itself has a private exchange with some great technology and a defined contribution model, which is really innovative for small business owners. And we're bringing people into the co-op. Our brokers are bringing people into the co-op. And I think it's an incredibly exciting thing for small businesses here in Illinois.
Wow. Defined contribution meaning, I mean, people say that, I think, 401k as opposed to defined benefit being a pension.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So what you can do now through this private exchange and through Land of Lincoln is if you have 10 employees, you can give them a certain amount of money and say, listen, we've got a broker that will help you shop. but go on to this private exchange and shop for the product that you want.
The health insurance product.
The health insurance product that you want. And you know, you may want to go bigger and better, and you might have to put in a little more money. You could go less grand, you know, a smaller network and whatnot, and it would be less, and you could use some of that savings to purchase other insurance, like dental or eye care. But instead of the employer having to dictate to everybody
right.
what it is that they're going to get, it adds competition, and it allows employees to pick plans that may focus on things that they want to focus on, like wellness and things of that nature.
Right, and different people of different ages and in different medical circumstances and stages in their life are going to gravitate toward different plans.
Absolutely.
That's fascinating.
It brings competition to the market, and, you know, hearing your previous conversation about, you know, large corporations and how they sort of can dominate, this is critical mass, and this is changing things by bringing people together and saying we can build something that can compete with these big folks and really alter the landscape.
Yeah. In fact, the phrase in this note that you sent, Sean, we are looking to disrupt an environment where only a few providers have control over health insurance and its pricing.
Absolutely.
That's pretty FDR. That's pretty cool stuff. Elliot Richardson, SBAC, although you're totally nonpartisan, I get it. SBAC, as in Small Business Advocacy Council, IL, as in Illinois.org. SBACIL.org. Thank you, Elliot.
Hey, Tom, thank you so much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And now we'll get back to Anything Goes Friday. My thoughts, your calls, the news of the day, right after this. By the way, welcome back. The situation in Ukraine continues to unravel. A couple of airports have been taken over by apparently privatized paramilitary forces that apparently are backed by Russia down in the Crimean region in the south. This is an ethnically Russian area, Russian language speaking area. At the same time that in Kiev, the Svoboda, if I'm saying that right, party, the basically the neo-Nazi party. Now, neo-Nazis from all over Europe are pouring into Kiev to participate in the revolution. Yeah. Oh, man. There's a piece over in the Daily Beast about it. You know, they start out with this white nationalist from Sweden saying Sweden isn't even Sweden anymore because they let the mongrels vote. And, you know, it's got to be white people for white people. And we can do this now. We have this opportunity in Ukraine with a revolution. We can create a new government. It's sort of like the Rand Paul libertarians. Let's tear down America so we can reestablish it all over again or something. I don't know. It's Jesse in Vashon, Washington. Hey, Jesse. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to talk about the global shift to wind, water, and solar as described by your recent guest, Stanford professor Mark Jacobson.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for having him on there, and I hope you'll have him back again and maybe in more detail. He just, on his website, his colleague's website, the Solutions Project just published plans for the 50 states. Of course, they have it for the whole world for a total conversion to wind, water, and solar for all purposes, heating, cooling, transportation, industrial processes, and that an important part of that project is the financial aspect of it. And so we're seeing now a greater calls. We saw Al Gore mention the carbon bubble and increasing divestment calls for divestment and risk assessment of these potential stranded assets. And this combined with your work on films like The Last Hour showed that this year, next year, I mean, we're right at the cusp. And we might pull it off, and we might not. So to me, this is the top story, especially the financial movements that are happening. Okay. And every block of carbon development is worth it because it's inevitable that it's going to happen. It's just, will it happen fast enough?
Yeah, I'm with you. And increasingly, we're seeing now that some of these large carbon-based companies are building, at the very least, a carbon tax into their estimates,
right.
future economic estimates. And you talk about stranded assets. People don't know what you're talking about, but increasingly people are. that there's, you know, there's billions of dollars, maybe trillions of dollars worth of carbon fuels that are still under the ground, that are on the books, on the balance sheets, listed as assets of these large multinational corporations, and even a lot of small ones, the fossil fuel companies, the fracking companies, the coal companies and whatnot. And if the day comes that a carbon tax is high enough that it's no longer economical to bring those out of the ground, but rather sun, you know, wind, solar, and other forms of renewable energy are more economical, then those companies are going to have to write off those assets. And if you are invested in one of those companies, you're going to get screwed. And so the divestment movement is not just a movement to say, like with South Africa, we don't support what you're up to. It's also, there's also a certain fairly substantial amount of self-preservation on the part of investors. It's increasingly. So, Jesse, you want to make one point before I move on?
No, that's okay. Pretty much it. I just hope you'll have him and his other colleague, Mark Ruffalo, the actor, is a great proponent of this project. They've teamed up. They've got it all. They've got the culture. They've got the finance and the science. And
Mark is great. We should get Mark on. Thank you for that call, Jesse, and thanks for pointing that out. Gary in Chicago, listen, WCPT, you wanted to talk about the Bible?
Well, yesterday you were talking about moral / Bible, but I think God is sending us a strong messaging. I heard this on your show. You said that pornography will make somebody stupid if they watch it too much, and a woman who has...
Did I say that?
...so many sex parts... What?
Did I say that?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever said watching pornography makes you stupid. I think watching television makes you stupid, and if it's porn on TV, it qualifies, but... I'm not sure that porn is any, frankly, I'm not sure that sexual porn is any different than the violence porn that we see on TV every day, or the political porn, frankly, that I'm watching on television, which is, politics filled with half-truths. But back to your point, Gary. You wanted to make a point.
Well, my point was that traditional values are important because women who have too many sex partners will have cervical cancer more likely. And so... it would seem that ignoring traditional value have negative consequences. But I thought that pornography thing was something that you said.
No, I'm not an opponent of pornography. I'm not a proponent of it either, frankly. But if you have sex with a lot of people, your risks of getting papillomavirus are increased, which causes cervical cancer. It also causes throat cancer in men and women. Your risks of a number of sexually transmitted diseases increase. On the other hand, I'm not, and we can find rooted in our historic morality sometimes really reasonable health reasons. Back in the day when syphilis and gonorrhea were fatal diseases, abstinence or virginity made a whole lot more sense. They are no longer a fatal disease, although there's now a fatal strain of gonorrhea that's come back in some parts of the world. But similarly, the injunction against eating pork, it used to have trichinomiasis, a parasite in it that would make you very, very sick. And shellfish, a lot of people are allergic to shellfish. And so, that could make you very sick. But that, just because something has traditionally always been our value isn't, in my mind, doesn't mean that we should hold to it because for that reason. We should hold to things for rational reasons. I'm not putting any of those things down. I'm just saying. Charles, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, listening on TuneIn. You wanted a clarification of my definitions of left and right?
Yeah, Tom, thank you for taking my call. Thank you for all that you do. Your education is very, very helpful.
Thank you.
In your first hour, Tom, you were discussing improved vision for an FDR-like progressive values and, and progressive vision. And it seems to me, for example, that Senator Warren not only talks the talk, but she also delivers. Example being her recent promotion of banking in the post office, recent discussion about expanding Social Security benefits, not cutting them back, versus the front runner, Secretary Clinton, and the historical coziness with Wall Street, the Summers type person, the Glass-Steagall repeal action seems to be more of the same. versus a true progressive vision for addressing issues of inequality, corporate influence, and Wall Street influence. And it would just seem like maybe it's too early. Maybe it would not work.
It is. I would love to see Elizabeth Warren run for president. I would love to see her on a ticket with Hillary Clinton. I have, on the one hand, a whole lot of things about Hillary Clinton that I really admire, and on the other hand, I'm kind of creeped out by the fact that she was on the board of directors of Walmart for 6 years. But on the third hand, I get it, that back in the 80s, and you wanted to be politically powerful, you wanted to become, your husband become governor of the state of Arkansas. That's what you did. And so, I don't think that we should be gaming that so much right now. What I'd rather point out is that there is a real difference between left and right. And the real difference between left and right goes back to the 1634, to Leviathan being published by Thomas Hobbes and his suggesting, A, that people are capable of governing themselves, which was a radical notion at that time, and thus kicked off the modern liberal movement and the Enlightenment. And B, Hobbes and Leviathan also saying that people are inherently evil, that because, as the Bible pointed out, you know, Eve sinned and then everybody was born from Eve. So we're all carrying that original sin with us. And because we're all evil, we have to have, in Hobbes's words, the iron fist of church or state to control us. And thus Hobbes kicked off the modern day conservative movement, both of them with the same book. And then, you know, Locke and Rousseau later in the 1770s and the 1780s took the progressive version of that, the liberal version of that, and turned it into, Locke's Second Treatise on Government famously talked about life, liberty, and private property. Thomas Jefferson turned that into life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that birthed America. Whereas the conservative vision that Hobbes held was in the 1700s, late 1700s, was being promoted by Sir Edmund Burke very aggressively in his, you know, great wars with Thomas Paine, and arguing that people should not be allowed to vote if they were not property owners, for example. So I think that the main cleavage between left and right comes down to this fundamental question that is still in debate of Hobbes's, which is, are people good or evil? And if they're good at their core, and evil is a deviance, then we are capable of governing ourselves, and small d democracy does work. And that's the liberal perspective. And if we're fundamentally evil and we're all in need of salvation, and there's only a few among us who are actually good, if good is the minority rather than the majority, then some form of oligarchy, kingdom, hierarchy, patriarchy makes sense.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I come down on the side that says that the majority of us are good, that we can govern ourselves, and therefore we don't need kingdoms and oligarchies and patriarchy. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. You wanted to talk about Democratic narratives?
Yeah, I think the Democrats do have a clear narrative. You know, health care for all, economic opportunity for all, and equal rights for everyone. And more importantly, they have an actual record. Obamacare gives, you know, good health care for all Americans, guarantees it. They're trying to raise the minimum wage and all wages by stimulating the economy. And, you know, they're trying to save the planet by increasing funds for solar and wind, and the EPA is regulating carbon. And, you know, I think the only reason that Bill Clinton wasn't more progressive is he ran into the Republican buzzsaw in Congress.
Yeah.
He tried to give everyone health care, but, you know, they wouldn't go along with that. And he actually did balance the budget and create 22 million jobs, and that grew wages. And, it's just that, laws are passed by Congress. It's not the president by himself.
No, I get that. I get that, Paul. I absolutely get that. So, but your critique of my critique of Clinton has a lot to go in for it. I don't disagree with it. That said, if the Democratic narrative is as clear as you said, health care for all, equal rights for all, a decent life for all, basically, retirement security for all, why don't the Democrats say it like that?
Well, they are. They've actually talked about economic quality, raise the minimum wage,
that's not equality.
Infrastructure, good jobs.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they're trying to do there. But the Republicans are like, no.
See, I think you could literally put small government on a bumper sticker and put it on somebody's car and ask 50 people who walk by, is that guy a Democrat or a Republican? And they'd say he's a Republican. If you put health care for all, well, actually, if you put health care for all on a bumper sticker, probably 50 people walking by would say that guy's a Democrat. Okay. Yeah, good point. So how do progressives and Democrats get together and message that more aggressively and get, I mean, for example, you've got Mary Landrieu and Mark Pryor, I think it is, the senators from Mississippi and Arkansas, as I recall, two Democrats, who are unwilling to sign on to the minimum wage, the $10.10 an hour raise in the minimum wage, which is why Harry Reid did not bring it to the floor of the Senate. He didn't have enough votes. And how do you get them on message?
Well, I mean, there's a couple dinos, you know, Democrats in name only, just like there's a couple rhinos. You know, I mean, you can't blame the whole Democratic Party because one or two people aren't on board. They actually vote with the Republicans.
Yeah. It just seems to me that there's much more message discipline in the Republican Party than there is in the Democratic Party. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, Will Rogers famously said, I am not a member of an organized political party. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah, that's true. Plus, the Republicans have the billionaire media, you know,
yes,
amplifying their their talking points.
Constantly. Yes, and the rich guys buying, you know, enough copies of every book that gets written by, you know, any right-wing wackadoodle that it hits the New York Times, and the appearance, you know, and they've got their own television network, Fox News, that's 24/7, a consistent message, as opposed to MSNBC, which, you know, has, you know, a Republican congressman on in the morning promoting a conservative message, and straight news pretty much the rest of the time, unless you're looking at prison documented. Paul, thank you. Good point. 10 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones up next with the Talk Radio News Service. Let's find out what's going on in the world. It is 10 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, occupying very often the Talk Radio News Service's offices in the basement of the White House, although it doesn't appear that you're there right now. With us, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Yes, I was there a little earlier today for the press briefing where Jay Carney, the spokesman for the White House, was peppered with questions about Ukraine and the disintegrating situation in the Russian-leaning autonomous region of Crimea.
Right. Now, is Crimea, you said autonomous region. I thought it was part of Ukraine. It's not?
It is. It is not. It is. Sorry. It is. Sorry.
But it's autonomous, sort of like Puerto Rico is to the United States.
It's an autonomous region within Ukraine.
So it would be more like Puerto Rico to the United States.
Yes, it elects its own parliament.
Okay. Very interesting. Yeah. Although they still are considered Ukrainian citizens.
Correct.
Okay.
They are, but it's even within electing their own parliament, it gets even more complicated and in the weeds.
Sure.
Within that, but they do elect their own parliament.
Okay. Now, but Crimea is
down, yes.
This is an area that's traditionally ethnically and linguistically Russian.
That's right. About 54-56% Russian, about 24% ethnic Iranian, about 12% Muslim Tatar, and then the rest made up of bits and bobs of other things.
Okay. So what's going on there?
Well, what's going on there today is basically, I mean, it started off with armed men in uniforms, some seeming to be Russian uniforms, it wasn't clear, taking over both main airports. And then as the day went on, many more things happening, including, according to airlines, saying the airspace over the peninsula has been cancelled, and so flights to and from the regional capital have been cancelled. Also, journalists, and I've seen pictures of this, reporting that the two main roads into it, because it's on a peninsula, into and out of the peninsula now have roadblocks that have been set up with armed men with automatic guns, stopping and searching trucks. and cars as they go into and out of Crimea.
Searching them, looking for what?
We don't know.
Hmm.
But they're searching them, and they're stopping them.
Yeah.
And some of these men seem to be from the Berkut, which is the riot police, the Ukrainian riot police. Some of them seem to be bikers.
Really?
Yeah, apparently, according to reports from the Wall Street Journal and the BBC.
Now, does that have any correlation with the report I read over at Daily Beast and Time magazine about how the European neo-Nazis are flooding into Ukraine right now?
Not clear whether these are biker Nazis or just bikers.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Not clear. Also, today, a senior Ukrainian official is telling local media that 13 Russian aircraft carrying nearly 2,000 suspected troops had landed at a military air base near Simferopol. Now, this remains unconfirmed, but that would be a major escalation.
Yeah.
So, meanwhile, President Putin has spoken with Western leaders of the extreme importance of not allowing a further escalation of violence. So those statements do seem to be in conflict with what's being reported from within Crimea, if indeed Putin and Russia have anything to do with what is going on inside Crimea.
Fascinating. Simferopol.
Ukraine's acting president, Turchinov, has accused Russia of deploying troops to Crimea and trying to provoke Kiev into armed conflict. He said in a televised address that Moscow wanted the new interim government to react to provocations so it could annex Crimea.
Wow. Interesting. So we could see, basically, this could be the beginning of Ukraine flying apart in bits and pieces.
Exactly. And that could, by the time I talk to you on Monday, we could have a whole different situation.
Right. And the odds are that there will not be any intervention or involvement by Western forces, by European forces, or Eastern European forces. Poland is right next to there, isn't it?
I think those are the odds. And Jay Carney was peppered with questions about this, including from me today at the White House briefing. Of course, he declined to answer. The UN Security Council is meeting this afternoon in New York. Of course, Russia is a member of the UN Security Council. So whether there would be any resolution, I think it's not likely. I don't know, even know whether these are formal talks or informal talks.
Right. Well, and there's still probably a debate about whether, if Russia were to lock down the situation, is that actually helping by reducing violence? I mean, you know, or is that,
right,
you know, or is that, as you suggested earlier, violence itself? I mean, I honestly don't know.
Exactly. So, exactly.
I don't think any of us do right now.
We
okay.
Don't,
what else is going on in the world?
We don't know. Senators Ron Wyden, Martin Heinrich, and Mark Udall, all on the Intelligence Committee, slammed the National Security Agency today after reports that its surveillance program captured images from users' webcams, particularly Yahoo. This is a report.
Wait a minute. I thought this was just GCHQ. This is U.S. intelligence as well?
Well, you see, it was reported that the NSA helped GCHQ to access and capture the images.
Oh-ho.
Oh, yes, the NSA.
And some large portion of them were basically teenagers shooting porn at each other, kind of, I guess.
Well, and grown-ups.
For lack of a better word. And grown-ups, yeah.
It was just everybody was at it, apparently.
Yes.
Nobody could keep their clothes on.
Right. People use those webcams for two things, you know, talking to grandma and flashing each other.
Flashing. This is what they use the webcams for. Apparently, this is a revelation to people, apparently. This is what they use webcams for.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, President Obama is arguing this afternoon in a speech to the Democratic National Committee that the 2014 midterm elections represent a clear choice between opportunity for all versus opportunity for the few.
I would say he's right in that, but very, very interesting that that's the message, and I'm glad to hear that. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And the president is speaking on what's going on in Ukraine right now. Let's go to that, and we're going to pick up Lamar Waldron in a few minutes.
And my administration has been in daily communication with Russian officials, and we've made clear that they can be part of an international community's effort to support the stability and success of a united Ukraine going forward, which is not only in the interest of the people of Ukraine and the international community, but also in Russia's interests. However, we are now deeply concerned by reports of military movements taken by the Russian Federation inside of Ukraine. Russia has a historic relationship with Ukraine, including cultural and economic ties, and a military facility in Crimea. But any violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity would be deeply destabilizing, which is not in the interest of Ukraine, Russia, or Europe. It would represent a profound interference in matters that must be determined by the Ukrainian people. It would be a clear violation of Russia's commitment to respect the independence and sovereignty and borders of Ukraine and of international laws. And just days after the world came to Russia for the Olympic Games, it would invite the condemnation of nations around the world. And indeed, the United States will stand with the international community in affirming that there will be costs for any military intervention in Ukraine. The events of the past several months remind us of how difficult democracy can be in a country with deep divisions. But the Ukrainian people have also reminded us that human beings have a universal right to determine their own future. Right now, the situation remains very fluid. Vice President Biden just spoke with the Prime Minister of Ukraine to assure him that in this difficult moment, the United States supports his government's efforts and stands for the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and democratic future of Ukraine. I also commend the Ukrainian government's restraint and its commitment to uphold its international obligations. We will continue to coordinate closely with our European allies. We will continue to communicate directly with the Russian government, and we will continue to keep all of you in the press corps and the American people informed as events develop. Thanks very much.
Very, very interesting. Well, the president's speaking on what's going on in Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula, and we will just have to wait and see how this all shakes out. I don't have a take on this that I feel solid enough to share with you right now. Lamar Waldron is on the line with us. He's a JFK historian and author of The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. Hey, Lamar, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you again, Tom.
Thank you. Abraham Bolden. Tell us about Abraham Bolden.
Well, his is one of the most tragic cases of, I think, injustice that in some ways still remains from the 1960s. I mean, there's a lot of cases of injustice in the American justice system, but this goes all the way back to 1964, not long after the president was assassinated. And it's just, you know, one more reason. I know there's a lot of controversy about, you know, should we continue to have a Black History Month, which this is the last day, or shouldn't Black History be taught, you know, every day of every year? And I'm a big believer in that. However, you know, there's still just so many parts of the story of civil rights and African Americans that are just not known by the public. And, you know, you and I have been trying to spread the word about Abraham Bolden. I realized since 1993
yeah.
at a presentation in Dallas, but so many people still don't know what it is. But here's why. It's such a tragic story. So he was a real civil rights pioneer, and he was the first African-American Secret Service agent assigned to the presidential detail, assigned to protect specifically President John F. Kennedy. And in fact, it was President Kennedy that personally selected Abraham Bolden to be the first black agent. And in those days, and he was selected back in 1961, the same year that JFK took office. You know, and you and I are old enough to remember how it was in those days. For an African American, you didn't have, you couldn't be just as good as a Caucasian to get a job or keep a job. You had to be far, far better.
Yeah.
And so JFK.
And this was an era where there were still whites only and colored only drinking fountains. And
oh, I was going to a whites only school until years after Bolden became joined the JFK's White House detail. So yes, this was a time of horrible discrimination, racial killings. A lot of the worst stuff in Mississippi was yet to come.
Right.
But JFK. He had been one of the first Democrats to really get overwhelming African-American support because he'd stood up for Martin Luther King when King was in that Georgia jail. So JFK was really determined to make progress on civil rights, very tough in Congress because you had the Democrats were a full spectrum party in those days, from the most conservative to the most liberal. But JFK could do actions like these. And so he would pick carefully, and actually Bolden had been assigned to guard a restroom when JFK was making an appearance in Chicago. So he was given a very low assignment because in those days, and as today, the Secret Service had a lot of other jobs like tracking down counterfeiters and those sorts of things. So he had been kind of, you know, sent to this back order, where you guard this men's room down on this other level away from the president. Well, JFK wound up going to that men's room. You know, saw this distinguished, you know, really clean-cut, all-American, you know, black gentleman, you know, guarding it and introduced himself, and they struck up a conversation, and JFK was very impressed by the man's demeanor, his intelligence, and so he said, you know, look, how would you like to come work for me, at the White House as part of the White House detail? And so that was just a huge thing at the time. There were no African-American presidential Secret Service agents. So that became a great opportunity for Bolden, and he went at it with great relish and worked very hard, and he had a sterling record and, you know, was a good
family. 2 minutes, Lamar.
I'm sorry, what was that again, Tom?
We have 2 minutes.
And so what happened with Bolden was he encountered a lot of racism, a huge amount of racism, saw a lot of lax activity on the part of the Secret Service, tried to talk to his supervisors about it. They didn't want to hear it. They sent him back to Chicago, and Bolden was part of dealing with an attempt to assassinate President Kennedy 3 weeks before Dallas in Chicago. He knew about the attempt to assassinate President Kennedy, very similar attempt in Tampa, 4 days before Dallas. I should say that was 3 weeks before Dallas was the attempt in Chicago. So Bolden knew that. He knew about the Secret Service's heavy drinking and all the laxity. And Secret Service were heavy drinkers, especially those on JFK's presidential detail. So about 6 months after JFK was killed, Bolden was going to go to Washington and tell the Warren Commission staff, hey, the Secret Service was at times lax in protecting the president. They were drinking heavily around that time. And by the way, you and the press haven't been told that JFK was almost killed in Chicago 3 weeks before Dallas and in Tampa, Florida during a long motorcade there. 4 days before Dallas, the day he was going to go up to Washington to talk to the Warren Commission staff about that. And Bolden had told a couple of his fellow agents he was going to be doing this. Bolden is arrested on the word of a couple of counterfeiters he had sent to jail. And he winds up spending 6 years in federal prison. Now, what you and I were able to do back when we were digging through all this JFK stuff in the early 90s, and then I kind of kept on digging after that, was to find out that Bolden had been completely framed. And in fact, his main accuser later admitted committing perjury and said someone with the district attorney's office in Chicago had told him to commit perjury. And so, you know, the evidence against Bolden, who was an upstanding Secret Service agent, just fell away, and he's been trying to clear his name ever since that time.
Is there a website for the effort to clear Abraham Bolden's name?
If people will go in about an hour to thehiddenhistoryofjfk.com, I'm going to start a new 30-day White House petition in an attempt to get a pardon for Abraham Bolden.
So thehiddenhistoryofjfk.com. Thank you, Lamar. Lamar Waldron.
Assassination.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lamar Waldron, author of The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. We'll be back. And welcome back. Michelle in Port St. Lucie, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on Roku. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Hey, Tom, this is Michelle. My husband and I think you're one of the most smart men on TV.
Well, thank you.
And radio. But I wanted to ask you, is there any correlation between, like, these big credit card companies like Chase, Morgan, and Citibank, but the way they handle things, and, like, the old company script and company stores of the past?
Oh, that's interesting. The for people who don't know what you're talking about, it used to be for people who don't know what you're talking about, it used to be that in company towns, basically, and you'd find this particularly around the extraction industries, you know, coal mining towns, where basically the business in town was the coal mine, and people were paid with script rather than with dollars, and they could use that script at the company store. And very often they would actually use their own credit at the company store, and they would end up, you know, the Tennessee Ernie Ford back in the 50s sang a famous song about this, you know. They would end up so in debt, they would pay the rent with the company script. Sometimes the company was, you know, owned the housing, that they ended up actually in debt, rather, you know, so they were continuously working, just trying to pay off the debt that they were incurring for their living expenses working. The closest I can get to that is that now increasingly food stamps and some other benefits, and this is happening mostly at the state levels and particularly in Republican-controlled states, they're distributing these benefits via these big banks, via debit cards, and the banks are taking a fee off the top. So people are having to pay a fee, or the government is paying the fee, depending on the state, for these benefits to be distributed, whereas they used to just, you know, cut a check and mail it to you. Does that make sense?
We're still paying for it.
Pardon?
We're still paying for it.
We're still paying for what?
We are the ones that are getting caught up in this situation.
Yes.
The lower income people, the middle class people.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes. And what's happened is it's basically just a new way that the banks have figured out to extract more government money and put it in their coffers and show a profit. The argument on the government side, and there's actually an argument to be made here, I just think that it, you know, this is why we need state banks, is that, you know, a lot of very low-income people don't have checking accounts. They can't easily cash a check. When they do, they get charged large fees by these phony baloney, you know, payday lending semi-banks. And that if you give somebody a card that they can use at the local Safeway or whatever, at the local grocery store, then that simplifies the process for them. They don't have to go through the whole check cashing thing and all that. But I don't think that welfare programs or social benefit programs, unemployment programs, should be an opportunity for banksters to make more money. I don't.
I do not either.
Yeah. But this is what has happened. I mean, this is part of this whole conservative idea that government can do nothing right. Private corporations can do everything right. So if government is going to give out benefits, run it through a private corporation, run it through a bank. And it's an abomination. Michelle, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on your Roku box. So Louise and I watch a lot of stuff on the various channels, including the Free Speech TV channel on Roku. It's a hoot. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Stephen in New York City, listening on WBAI, you wanted to comment on the Ukraine situation?
Hi, good afternoon. Mm-hmm. How are you?
I'm fine. And the coverage thereof?
Well, with respect to the Ukraine, I wanted to follow up on Victoria Jones's report.
Mm-hmm.
About apparent Russian military movements in and around the Crimea.
Right.
And I've been watching this situation with the using various YouTube channels from, I suppose, individual civilian Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. On the ground.
Do you speak any of the languages of that region?
No, no, I don't.
Okay.
But on one particular channel where they're like sort of coastal watchers were in World War II,
mm-hmm.
if, you know, volunteers watching like the West Coast, the East Coast for
right.
submarines and that sort of thing.
Right.
And so these folks have been videotaping various movements of Russian military equipment. And this began some days ago with armored personnel carriers showing up in various towns where they don't usually show up. The most just military convoys and a posting dated today of overflights of squadrons of Russian military attack helicopters
right.
In or around
the Crimean Peninsula.
The Crimea.
Yeah.
So that's fairly disturbing.
It could be. I mean, let's flip this around for a second. If the democratically elected Prime Minister of Canada had fled the country because he was afraid for his life, and protesters in the streets of Ottawa had shot and taken hostage police officers, and there was some evidence that this basically coup against Canada had been orchestrated by China, and there was a lot of and in fact, we heard the ambassador, a tape recording of the ambassador of China, to Canada saying...
You're referring to Victoria Nuland.
I am. Saying, we've already decided who's going to be running Canada. Don't worry, we got this under control. And you know, screw the Americans and their influence. We've got this. Don't you think that the President of the United States would be ordering troops to the Canadian border?
Why should... This is a remarkable, I have to say this, Mr. Hartman, this is a remarkable suggestion from a progressive spokesperson that an internal disturbance in our neighbor to the north that has no potential threat to the United States would call for the mobilization of troops to the to our northern border.
I'm not saying it would be a good thing or that I would support it. I'm saying, don't you think that it would happen?
No, I don't think it would necessarily happen with a president who had his wits about him.
Hmm.
And I certainly don't think it should happen if the American left made sure that there was non-intervention in the internal affairs of our Maple Leaf brothers.
Yeah.
So with that said, I do have to disagree with your characterization of the Maidan events and others throughout most of the Ukraine as being a coup.
How do you describe it when a democratically elected president is evicted from office?
This was a popular uprising,
okay.
which is quite different from a coup. Merriam-Webster defines a coup as the sudden change of a government brought about frequently by conspiracy. I would further say that it's frequently brought about by a small faction within one of the institutions of the government.
Okay. Then you know, was this...
Let me just finish.
Was the Civil War a coup? Or a popular uprising, rather?
The Civil War was not a popular uprising. In the way that we understand popular uprising,
uh-huh. So what's? I'd like to just drill down into this a little. Trying not to present a position on this because I am very uncertain about what's going on there.
But I believe you are.
And I understand that. And that's so. If you have half of the eastern half of Ukraine is ethnically Russian and Russian speaking, the western half of Ukraine is Ukrainian by and large, ethnically, and speaks Ukrainian. The current president is from the Russian part. He only learned the Ukrainian language in his 50s, or the president that just got bounced out. I'm trying to find some kind of historical parallel or put this in a frame that I can understand it better.
I would put it in the following way, that it is a similar uprising to what occurred in the Paris Commune in 1871. And I say this for the following reason.
You're talking about the one that was put down so brutally by the French government?
Well, I would suggest...
Did you say 1791?
1871.
1871. Okay.
The Paris Commune,
right,
of which Karl Marx suggested that it was the world's first example of the dictatorship of the proletariat.
Right.
Now,
and it was suppressed by the French government, was it not?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the French government, because this happened at the end of the Franco-Prussian War,
right,
and which was started by Napoleon III. He was captured at Sedan, which was the great defeat of that war, and led to the French capitulation.
Stephen, we're flat out of time, and it's a hard break. I'm very, very sorry. Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Please call me back Monday. Let's continue this conversation. I'm, you know, this is the nature of radio. We'll be back. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where despair is not an option. Randy in Minneapolis, listening on KTNF. You want to disagree with me about something? Randy, you are on the air. Well, maybe he's not on the air. Okay, let's try Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Tom, should the oil industry and the internet be nationalized by the government?
I don't think that the oil industry should be nationalized, but I think that the oil should be nationalized. We should do what Norway has done. And what, in a very, very small way, Alaska has done. And we should say the oil under the ground of the United States is the property of the people of the United States. And not just the oil, frankly. I would make this the case with anything that's extractive, you know, whether it's the copper or the coal or the oil or the natural gas. And we will sell it to private corporations that want to refine it or transport it or use it. But the money comes to us, to we the people. Norwegians are very, very wealthy right now because they discovered oil off the north, well, it was the north shore of the United Kingdom and off the east coast of Norway. And they've created the equivalent of the Alaska Permanent Fund. They've got this giant permanent fund. It's one of the largest sovereign wealth funds in the world. And it pays for the education of Norwegians. It pays for the pensions of Norwegians. And, you know, it's, yeah. So am I... Did you want to dispute that, or were you just asking my opinion, or was there someplace you were going with it?
I was asking your opinion, and how about the Internet?
I think the Internet should be considered part of the commons, just like our public schools, just like our highways. I think it is the new information commons. It is the new version of public libraries, and therefore it should not be privatized. I think that any private corporation that wants to bring the Internet into your home should have to do so on a common carrier basis, on a regulated basis where they're functioning as a common carrier, and any Internet service provider can provide content over their lines. So, you know, I think these should not be privatized. Karen in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Karen, you wanted to talk about disabled people?
Yes, Tom, I want to... Because you've talked quite a bit about what Goodwill pays and so on and so forth about disabled people.
Yeah, it's a two-edged sword.
Well, my sister was a developmentally disabled person, is.
Mm-hmm.
And when my father died, she got a VA small VA death benefit that she received on his Social Security or his VA benefit. And when she went to work at Goodwill, they let her work more enough that she lost that because most disabled people receive some sort of assistance, and that assistance is based upon that they don't earn money.
Right.
They created that job for her at Goodwill in order to have for her to have something to do besides stare at the four walls in her group home.
Right.
So there are a lot of disabled people that cannot earn enough. They're not trying to support themselves. They're not trying to pay for their housing and their food. You know, but they do need to do things outside of being institutionalized or, you know, just not doing anything.
Yeah, I understand. That's why I said it's a two-edged sword. I know in our newscast it sort of characterizes it purely as the exploitation of, in this case, I think mentally disabled people or handicapped, or intellectually handicapped. But the, you know, there's on the one hand, there is, I think, an element of exploitation to it. On the other hand, you're absolutely right. For a lot of folks who, you know, particularly people like with Down syndrome and things, this is the only opportunity that they have to get out there in the world and do something. I think that employers, a member of my family, I don't want to get more personal and more detailed than that, an in-law member of my family is fairly severely intellectually handicapped. And she has been working at a local McDonald's for years. I mean, and she does a good job at what she does. She can't do much more than that. But they pay her minimum wage. You know, it's like this is, you know, in one of the southern states. And I think there's something to be said for that.
I think that as long as people understand that, and I can't speak for a lot of other jobs they would have tried to send her on. She had to have a job coach a good deal of the time because she really wasn't capable of being a productive employee.
Yeah.
But that's the reason where these jobs come from that are like 23 cents an hour or whatever they are, is because they're making something for these people to do. You know, and she worked behind the scenes at Goodwill. She didn't work out with the people.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it just so people understand that it's not all, you know, people just taking advantage of disabled people.
I agree.
Thank
you, Karen. You did a very good job of that, and you're right. There's really two sides to that story. Thank you for the call. Russell in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. Hey, Russell, what's up?
Hey, Tom. A couple things. One, you were talking earlier about if people see healthcare for all, they think Democrats. I actually think that it's a big problem because Obamacare obviously is not healthcare for all. And
it's healthcare for most.
Your buddy, Senator Sanders introduced a single payer bill, but he hasn't been able to get one of his fellow senators to sign on, not your fan Elizabeth Warren, not, you know, any of the Lib Dems in the Senate. And so you might want to ask them next time they come on, how come they're not signing on with the true health care for all bill, which is single payer. And the second thing is,
are you sure that Bernie was not able to get any co-sponsors?
Zero.
You're sure?
All alone. Absolutely positive.
Huh.
He's all alone. The argument they're giving him, people would tell me this, the argument they're giving him is that, you know,
why tilt the windmills.
Single payer, in an election year, if we sign on with single payer, what's that going to make Obamacare look like? What are we saying about Obamacare?
Right.
And basically what you were saying about Obamacare is that it sucks. That, you know, you can, like for myself, I got a subsidy, but what is it? It's like $14,000 out of pocket, and I can't go to the hospitals I want to go to. I've got to go to the crap hospitals in West Virginia. I can't go to one in Hagerstown. I can't go to one in Winchester. My kids can't go there. So there's all kinds of problems with it instead of, you know, everybody in, nobody out. The second thing that I wanted to mention was I think that
Russell, let me just punctuate that. That said, it's better than a system that is entirely for profit. I mean, Obamacare has ring-fenced somewhat by saying, you know, for example, you can't make more than 20% in your expenses. You can't, you know, you can't gouge people. You can't reject people. It is better than what we had. I agree with you. It is not single payer. It is not the perfect system. But I think frankly it also, and I don't know what role Bernie played in this or not, but you know, Obamacare also allows states in 2016 to start their own single payer systems, and Vermont has already voted to do that. And we'll see if they can hang on to that through two election cycles, but I hope that they will be able to. And if so, go ahead.
I would suggest you have on Dr. Marcia Angel, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, who argues that Obamacare is not better than nothing and that we should have defeated it and moved towards single payer. But
yeah,
anyway,
well, see, that was Ted Kennedy's position in 73 with regard to Richard Nixon, who was proposing something almost identical to Obamacare. And look at what happened.
Correct. Okay, so the reason I actually called, I've been on hold for an hour, so I wanted to get this in, was the whole question of Citizens United, and I believe that the left uses that as a crutch. So, for example, in West Virginia, for the House of Delegates, which for the first time in 80 years probably will go Republican this year, there are 100 House of Delegates seats, and they can be won, at least in our area of West Virginia, with 3,000 votes. And we're actually going to run a slate of independents to try and grab a couple of them. But they can be won with 3,000 votes. It's at the local level, it's not about the money.
It's about turnout?
It's about the hustle. Yeah. And what I'm saying is, you know, basically, if you look at like the Adolf Reed piece in Harper's, and a lot of lefties say, oh, you know, the system's corrupt, there's too much money in it, we need a constitutional amendment.
Well, Adolf Reed was not calling for that. What Adolf Reed was talking about in Harper's, the long, slow surrender of American liberals, was, I believe, it's a long piece, and you could probably pull a lot of calls to action out of it. But I thought he was basically calling for progressives, liberals, whatever, to hew back to a core vision and articulate it in a clean, straightforward fashion.
Well, I agree with that, but what I'm saying is that a lot of liberals say that don't enter the electoral arena because it's corrupted with money and there's nothing you can do until we get money out of it. And that's totally not true.
I agree.
In fact,
I don't know anybody who said that.
I hear a lot of people say that.
I've never said that. I've never had a guest on this program say that. And the politicians we have in this program obviously don't believe that. They are in the electoral arena.
Well, that's correct. But I mean, okay, well, but
I think that's a minority position.
It as a crutch.
Okay.
I do see the left using it as a crutch and not entering the electoral arena as because they think the whole thing's corrupted. My argument is we should enter it as independents and try and grab some of these local seats.
See, and I think that I don't disagree with you that people should be entering the electoral arena, but you've got this you've got this multi-billion dollar machine called the Democratic Party that is sitting there with the doors wide open. If you and I were to conspire to take over NBC and turn it into Fox News, we'd have to raise billions of dollars. But, you know, look at what the Tea Party did with the Concord Coalition with just a bunch of CDs back in 2008, 2010, getting Tea Partiers in the positions of precinct committee chairs. Hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I think, Russell, if, you know, with a large enough effort, we could take over at least significant enough chunks of the Democratic Party and lever that machine. That's my... Russell, thank you. Welcome back. Jerry in Long Island, listening on WBAI. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Remember yesterday, towards the end of your program, you had at least two individuals discussing Social Security COLAs, cost of living adjustments,
yes,
and change CPR. Yeah, I'd like to discuss that. I'd like to discuss something disturbing that I've learned the White House spokesman said about it, and also my own solution to protect Social Security cost of living adjustments.
Okay.
First of all, duplicitously, in my opinion, according to the Huffington Post online, White House spokesman Josh Earnest, not Jay Carney, but Josh Earnest, has said that, quote, the change CPI offer remains on the table, end of quote, even though reportedly, according to the Associated Press, and you mentioned this too, even though according to the Associated Press, cuts to Social Security won't be included in President Obama's own budget due out next week. And so I think we still need to contact the White House, call them, contact them in some other way, and tell them to stop the scoping talk and take Social Security and the chain CPI off the table altogether and forever, instead of trying to have it both ways by telling one thing to the Associated Press and then having spokesmen come out and say something else after they get criticized by John Boehner. And I also think that we need to tell the White House to stop letting the Social Security Administration seemingly on its own reduce or eliminate Social Security cost of living adjustments altogether. I don't know if many people know this, Tom, but in the absence of a chain CPI, the Social Security Administration under President Obama, unfortunately, has reduced Social Security COLAs by eliminating them altogether for 2 years in a row and then cutting them in half in 2013. And this year will be at one of the lowest levels ever, just 1.5%. And so,
those are not arbitrary decisions, Jerry. Those are based on a formula that they use to determine whether or not inflation is hitting. And, I agree with Bernie Sanders. That formula should be reconfigured to reflect the realities of senior citizens in this country.
Can I mention my solution?
Please.
My solution would be a piece of legislation that you can call the Social Security COLA Protection Act, or SCOLAPA for short, spelt with two S's, and it would prevent the Social Security COLAs from ever going below 3% or below 3.5%. It would be a floor, not a ceiling, and it would prevent the Social Security cost of living adjustments going below this level, which they've been traditionally at, regardless of any other factor involved in calculating these cost of living adjustments. Because this is the problem we currently face, is that even under President Bush, the COLAs were at least 3 or 3.5%. I know the Social Security Administration is claiming that for 2 years in a row, there was no increase in the cost of living.
There was no significant inflation,
Well, this is why I think we need to protect the Social Security COLAs from ever going below.
But here's the problem with your suggestion, Jerry. If we did that and we said, okay, there's a floor of 3% under, so Social Security COLAs are going to be a minimum of 3%. I would not be opposed to that for a decade, just to make up the lost buying power that Social Security has had since the 60s, for example, or since the 30s. But if it just went forward forever, it would radically disrupt the ability of the Social Security actuaries to calculate future benefits or current, payments. It seems. Although I suppose, they could do the math. Jerry, let me think about it. It's an interesting idea. And thank you for listening to WBAI. We'll be right back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at the various organizations that syndicate this program, Westwood One on commercial radio, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and all the others around the country. To all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman, Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Janet in Topeka, Kansas. Hey, Janet, you wanted to respond to an earlier caller?
Yes. Oh, yes. By the way, I've read The Fourth Turning, too. You're the only person I know who's read it also. But at any rate, I wanted to comment on the issue about generations and conservative versus liberal.
Mm-hmm.
You had a caller on earlier who described, I'm from baby boomer, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The baby boomers have always been primarily polarized, and it was so during the Vietnam War and during the civil rights movement and even the women's movement, especially.
Yeah.
that I remember during my college days back in the 60s, dealing with people like George Bush, you know, who were skating out of everything. And, mm-hmm. you know, my husband went off to the war and came back disabled. The other piece is the characterization of the conservative mind. I don't think in my discussions, living in Kansas, I have lots of opportunity to talk with really hardcore conservatives.
Yeah.
They don't like complexity, you know, that I think the liberal mind or the progressive mind tends to be fascinated with complexity.
And nuance.
And, you know, there is no exact right answer. There's all shades of gray in there. But that's one of the most difficult things about that conservative mind, that when confronted with complexity, they appear to go into almost a cognitive dissonance where they just shut down.
Well, I think that Russell Kirk even admitted that in 1951 when he published The Conservative Mind, and it was an ode to conservatism. But basically he was saying, you know, conservatives hold to very clear, specific values. This is where we stand, period. No changing. And he set out to identify some of those values. And I think you're right. I think the idea of complexity or nuance is not within the conservative worldview. Keep in mind, as much as conservatives love to invoke the names of the founders of this country, the founders of this country were the lefty radicals of their day. The conservatives were the ones who said we should stay with England.
Yes. Well, and the other piece is the Greatest Generation and what was going on between the boomers and the Greatest Generation. My father and my mother, I mean, I'm third generation Kansan. And what marked them? That generation was marked by the Depression.
Yeah.
And World War II.
Yeah.
And I mean, I grew up listening to stories about how Franklin Roosevelt was a god. Mm-hmm. You know, John L. Lewis, a god. You know, my dad was a union organizer.
Mm-hmm.
And the stories in the Great Depression of the locust plagues and the dirt, you know, seeping in around the windowsills, mm-hmm. and all of this, and the starving children.
And FDR put an end to it by you know, with the CCC planting trees to break up the wind, you know, in the Midwest.
Yes, especially in places like and women back trying to hold down the farm while on the road looking dark. You know, it was an incredibly traumatic time, and we've forgotten it. You know, we don't know our story, our generational stories. And they need to be passed on, because that's my great fear. We may be headed into another deal like in the 1920s and 30s.
Oh, I think we are, and that's going to be the kids who are the teenagers and the 20-somethings now. That's going to be their story when they're in their 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Yes, yes. Well, that's my comment.
Okay.
And great show.
Thank you, Janet. Thank you for the call. A very thoughtful comment. Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff, we got a minute left. It's all yours.
You can do it fast. Ballotpedia.org is some place everybody should know about. Right now, if you look at a state like Illinois, there are 6 Republicans that are guaranteed election in the state legislature. And as you well know, the state legislatures are the ones that are doing the biggest damage to the country. The Democrats couldn't even get 6 people to even run against these people. So I beg of a lot of people out there, there are offices all around the country, local offices, school boards, city council, where they're
Ballotpedia. This is the first time I've seen this website, Jeff. Ballotpedia.org.
It lists the elections by state, so you can see what the elections are. And you can find out in Illinois, out of 19 seats, 16 are unopposed. So
Wow. We
can't even get 2 people to run for offices around the country. And so you've got millions of listeners. We've got to have thousands of people listening to you who could use a job and get one by just people voting for them.
Ballotpedia, an interactive almanac of U.S. politics. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yep.
Yep. And click on your state. Okay, cool. I'm going to have to spend some time with the site. Jeff, thanks for the heads up. And I agree with you. Democracy is not a spectator sport. It does begin with you. And if you may be living in an area where there's an uncontested race, you could be the contestant. So get out there and get active. Get over to ballotpedia.org. Check it out. And you know all of it. You know, there's a lot of great sites. But we can't just sit back and we can't, you know, complaining is just not a useful thing. So tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.